argument is Siddiqui v. Holder. Mr. Theriot Orr.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Devin Theriot Orr for the petitioner, Mohsen Siddiqui. In this case, we have a fairly complex immigration matter that is quite atypical. The USCIS Administrative Appeals Office has abandoned its role under the statutory scheme, and the resulting decisions here are wholly unsupported by the record evidence. And the decisions are also contrary to a binding class action settlement agreement between the Attorney General and my client. This Court should therefore grant the petitions. Given the complexity of the case and the number of issues, I'm just going to focus on three points this morning. First, the evidence in the record is undisputed, and there's no adverse credibility finding from the agency here as to any of the declarations or affidavits as to physical presence. The physical presence is...
Yes, so your argument is that he entered the United States, I guess, 1979, and he was 11. Is that the idea? Is that the...
I believe that the record establishes that he was born in 1966, so he would have been 12 or 13 in 1979.
So the argument is he entered when he was 13.
He entered.
Did he have parents?
His parents just recently received lawful residence here, so they were in Pakistan.
I can't hear you. What?
His parents just recently came to the United States as lawful immigrants, but they were in Pakistan.
So he came by himself at 13?
He came to stay with a family friend, is what the record establishes.
He came by himself?
Yes.
Okay.
The physical presence evidence in the record establishes he has wage earning records, which are objective evidence of his presence here in 1985, 1986, and 1988.
Isn't your argument that the board or the immigration judge treated the evidence too casually with all this boilerplate?
That's the second point I was going to make, Your Honor. Yes, and
I don't think we can't make a finding about this, can we?
Well, I mean, certainly the court is empowered to make such a finding if the record compels the conclusion that he establishes physical presence.
I don't think the record compels it. It's a matter of evaluating these affidavits. Or was there any live testimony?
He was interviewed, and the way that these cases work is that he's called for an interview with the district director of USCIS. And the district director then has the power to call some of the witnesses if they wish. And they're supposed to make, under the regulations, a contemporaneous record of any such phone calls. I think if you look at the agency's decisions here, and I direct the court to pages 6 and 13 of the DHS administrative record, which are the life and CSS decisions, respectively, for the sixth page on the third full paragraph and then on the 13th page on the first full paragraph, they both contain the same text, starting with, none of the statements contain yada, yada, yada. And as I pointed out, this language appears in many, many, many other U.S. AAO decisions. It's plainly boilerplate. And if you look at the record evidence in pages 185 to 189, page 195, page 306, these are detailed, verifiable affidavits, and there's no way that you can read the agency's decisions and then read these affidavits and come up with a conclusion other than that they're totally inconsistent with each other. So, this court's obligation under the statute...
What's inconsistent with what? I miss...
If you read the agency's decisions on pages 6 and 13 of the administrative record, they both contain identical texts that start with, going with the 13th page, the first full paragraph is...
Let me see if I can find this. Is this the... Are you talking about the administrative law judge's opinion?
Or? No, Your Honor. This is the DHS administrative record. So this would be the decision from the Administrative Appeals Office.
Okay.
It's on page 13 of the DHS administrative record. The first full paragraph starts with none of the witness statements and goes from there. And that language, if you read that language, it talks about, they're not verifiable, they don't provide any information about how the affiants have this information. That statement is targeting boilerplate affidavits, these kind of form affidavits that were submitted. There's a couple in this case, I will acknowledge, but there's just a couple. And there's a lot of other detailed, verifiable evidence. And the AAO either didn't read it or didn't consider it. Certainly their decision...
What he means by none of the witness statements provide concrete information. So that's referring to the form affidavits.
Well, I guess so. But, it starts with none of the witness statements. So the AAO is referring to all of his statements. And there's no way to read that statement and read Mr. Kaja's declaration at page 185 of the DHSAR, which is quite detailed. It says that Mr. Siddiqui was a teenager when he came here. He lived in my house. He worked in my auto shop. Provides his address, the same address that he's been living at since he came to the United States. He was an lawful permanent resident of the United States since this affiant since 1974. He became a naturalized citizen. Why is this important? Because one of the things that DHS likes is to be able to verify the information, right? So all the district director had to do was pick up the phone, call this guy's phone number, same phone number as on the affidavit, and say, hey, did you really know this guy? Well, how did you know him? Why was he, here as a teenager? What was he doing there? He could have found all that information. And then if they didn't believe him, they could have pulled up Mr. Kaja's A file in their system and said, oh, yeah, well, he was here in 1974. And, oh, he became a naturalized citizen in 1994. So he's been here the entire time. So he's seems like a pretty credible witness. There's no indication that the agency did that. And its decision is bereft of analysis of the relevant affidavits. The last thing I wanted to point out is just to briefly talk about the knife possession offense here. The knife possession offense from 1992 does not bar relief because there's a class action settlement agreement from 2004 between the same parties that are before you today. And that agreement was entered after a fairness hearing, and the district court in that case in the Eastern District of California determined that allowing nunk-pro-tunk relief was required under the class action case. That it basically said, the claims presented here require the agency to adjudicate the applications under the law in existence in the late 1980s. The settlement agreement is very clear. The AAO doesn't address the settlement agreement. The respondent before this court doesn't address the settlement agreement other than to say, well, it just doesn't apply. If the Attorney General did not believe that the settlement agreement was a good idea or that it was not enforceable, he should have told that to the Eastern District of California when the settlement agreement was approved. And I'd particularly like to point the court out, Petitioner's Appendix H is the settlement agreement, and this was signed by the Associate General Counsel for the Department of Homeland Security, and paragraph 20 says even after it's signed, it was signed in 2003, in April and May of 2003 by the parties, but the fairness hearing didn't happen until January 2004. Why is that? Because that agreement was not enforceable until it was approved by the Deputy Attorney General of the United States and the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. So this case went to the highest levels of the United States government and received the approval of those individuals before it was entered into after a fairness hearing. So we'd ask the court to grant the petition, and I'll reserve the balance of my time if there's no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Theriodor. Mr. Norwood?
May it please the court. My name is Anthony Norwood, and I'm here representing the respondent today. Judge Posner, I'd like to address your first question. I'd like to know who the family friend was that this young boy came to live with in 1979 in Dallas, Texas. We don't know who that is. We have no evidence, we have no claim that he came to live with a family friend in Dallas, Texas in 1979.
That doesn't seem to have been the ground of the administrative judge's decision. How do you respond to this statement that respond to Mr. Theodore's argument that this language in the AO in the immigration judge's opinion, none of the witness statements provide, etc., is not responsive to the actual contents of the affidavit?
Your Honor, the agency's decisions find that petitioner's evidence does not establish that he entered the United States before January 1st, 1982.
I'm talking about that. I'm talking about a specific sentence in the report which simply rejects all of the affidavits on the ground that they're not specific to the applicant, do not provide concrete information. Well, that's not true, right? That's another false statement in an immigration judge's opinion.
Well, it's the AAO, Your Honor, and I don't. It's not a complete. It's the Administrative Appeals Office, Your Honor. It's not the immigration judge.
Fine.
But it's not a false statement, Your Honor. It's not a complete statement.
It says specific to the applicant. Now, do any of these affidavits mention the applicant by name?
Oh, they do mention the applicant.
Well, then that's specific to the applicant.
They don't mention where. There's nothing from Dallas, Texas. They don't mention whether he was in school. His family doesn't mention anything about when he entered the United States. They're bland.
Those are perfectly good points, but they're not. Apparently, this is some piece of boilerplate that appears in hundreds of opinions of this Administrative Appeals Office. What's going on here?
Your Honor, these decisions do cite, they do show that the AAO read those.
No, they don't. Because this is a false statement about these affidavits.
Your Honor, I don't believe those statements are false. They're not complete, but they're not false.
Well, if they're not complete, they're not credible.
Your Honor, I think it's the petitioner's claim that's not credible. There's no records from school. There's no statement that there was a family friend. They say his parents are in the United States. There's nothing from his parents. The earliest thing we have is that he claimed.
So why don't they say that? Instead, this document repeats verbatim this business. None of the witness statements contain. What's going on here? The computer, what? The author accidentally, what? Copied the same sentence in?
Your Honor, he has. The
embarrassed to defend these people. I don't understand it. Why is this repeated verbatim on the next page?
I believe that's a typographical error or
what
computing error.
Typographical error.
Same sentence. It's going to be a computing error or a typographical error.
It's never read over, right? It's supposed to catch these things.
What you also have is you have three bites of the apple, and the reason the life legalization decision and the regular legalization decision are identical is because petitioner had the opportunity to apply for the exact same relief at least three times. He's been able to apply for legalization three times since 1990.
What do you have a comment about the settlement agreement?
I do, Your Honor. The settlement agreement provides that the government would adjudicate these legalization applications under the regulations and the administrative precedent that existed in 1987, 1988, and the statute 245A. The settlement agreement does not purport to abrogate congressional right to change the law. Congress changed the law, and they not only changed the law, they very clearly changed the law that said this definition of a conviction.
Well, there's no question about that, but the settlement agreement established the law under which these applications for everybody covered by the settlement agreement were to be adjudicated, not the then current law, which granted had been changed, but the law that was in effect during the original application period when the constitutional violation occurred.
The settlement agreement does not refer to it refers to Section 245A and the administrative regulations and precedent. It doesn't refer to this brand new definition of a conviction. This is the first time there's a definition.
Does it refer to the old definition of conviction?
There was no statute. This is the first statutory definition of a conviction. There was Matter of Oscok was a board decision. This was the very first.
So the definition of conviction, meaning a disqualifying conviction, existed as a matter of INS case law.
INS case law at the time.
So the language of the settlement agreement that refers to the judicial precedents of the INS during the application period would incorporate that old definition.
It would, Your Honor, but it doesn't purport, and I suggest that the settlement agreement would have to say.
You're saying we don't just interpret the settlement agreement because the settlement agreement was overridden by later legislation? Is that your proposition?
I'm saying that.
Is that your proposition? Yes or no?
Yes, I suppose. Congress changed the law. Yes, it is.
Did Congress say, you know, there's a settlement agreement, we're abrogating it?
Congress did not refer to the settlement agreement.
Create vested rights. It's not always that easy to wipe them out by legislation.
It's not very easy, Your Honor, and this was a very, very special case in all the courts of appeal.
Congress say, we're abrogating the settlement agreement or we're modifying the settlement agreement?
Congress did not refer to the settlement agreement.
Well, then what makes you think Congress meant to screw up settlement agreements?
I think that Congress meant what it said when it said convictions on, before, or after.
That's not the question. The question is, did Congress intend to abrogate a settlement agreement?
There's no indication that Congress was aware of the settlement agreement.
Well, if it wasn't aware of it, what makes you think it abrogated it?
Because
it's you think every time Congress passes a law, one goes looking back through judgments and settlements to see whether they're consistent with the new law?
No, Your Honor. But this is a very...
Why in this case, then?
Because Congress's language was so clear. Every court has upheld
Congress. So you're saying whenever Congress is able to legislate clearly, we can go back and dig through a couple of hundred years of judgments and settlements and so on to see whether they're consistent with the latest congressional enactment.
When Congress makes a clear definition of the statute
that goes
before, on, or after.
Don't go on. That's what you're saying, right?
But
what I've stated is your position. Clear statutory language overrides judgments and settlements. That's your position.
If
right?
they're being applied.
That is your position.
Yes.
Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. If
yes.
they're being applied
That's
at
ridiculous.
The time.
I think it's ridiculous.
If the agency is applying the statute, the agency is going to be applying the statute into the future.
If they're
interpreting it today, they have to apply the statute today.
But you said Congress didn't even know about the settlement.
Congress knew about our settlements. Congress tried to change this law three times. But there's no evidence that
no indication Congress was thinking about the settlement.
not with that definition of conviction.
You know, like a whale... swishing its tail kills 1,000 fish, right? So without intending to do anything, they of course this makes settlements a lot less valuable because you never know. It may be clear language in a later statute, and the party to the settlement will come and say, oh well, yeah, we're not bound by this settlement anymore.
What's the actual chronology here? The class action suit was filed in 1988.
The CSS case was class action was filed in 1988.
And when was it settled?
2003. Congress passed the law in 1996 and amended the conviction, and the plaintiffs in the settlement agreement didn't themselves try to get us to agree not to use the new current application.
So the settlement agreement was entered into by the Department of Justice after Congress changed the law.
After Congress changed the law.
In 2004.
2004.
So really you're suggesting, are you not, that the department didn't have the authority to enter into the agreement?
I'm not saying we didn't have the authority to enter the agreement. I'm saying that the definition of a conviction was right there at the time that we entered into the agreement.
Yes, but you entered into an agreement that said that law doesn't apply. The law that applies is the law that was in effect during the 1980s. Application period, which you have a right to do on behalf of your clients, give away a legal point in your favor, but you didn't do that. That's you didn't preserve the current law. You said we'll be bound by the law that was in effect during the application period.
The administrative law on the precedent.
So you're saying it's an illegal settlement.
I'm not trying to say that our settlement is an illegal settlement, Your Honor.
It's just contrary to congressional enactment.
I don't think that it changes the definition of a conviction.
It's unenforceable.
It's been enforced. I've got thousands of claims. We've been enforcing it.
But it's illegal.
I hope
so
this court
the other claims that you have been adjudicating, you're using the definition of conviction that existed during the 1980s under
Your Honor. I've never seen this conviction issue come up before.
That's just really hard to believe.
I'm just saying, I have never seen it, but this hasn't been
run up the flagpole at the Department of Justice?
It's not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
Mr.
Okay.
Orr,
can I
just ask one other thing? On this question of the so-called boilerplate language, field officers make determinations, but we don't review their assessments.
That's
so
correct.
It might help in speaking to the specificity issue if there was at least a reference to the assessment of field officers.
Your Honor, I don't doubt that the agency's decision could be more clear.
Gives us a little more comfort on it.
I don't doubt that, Your Honor.
We don't get to it, but there is often a more detailed assessment made by a field officer.
There is often.
Causes the final decision to be made.
There is often, Your Honor.
You do concede that if the old adjudicatory definition of conviction applies in this case, the petitioner's conviction doesn't count.
No, I don't concede that, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because he argues that matter of Oscop should be applied to his definition
of conviction.
Right, and
asking you to assume that it does. Okay, so
that it does, Your Honor.
Okay, I understand you object to that, but let's say we decide you're wrong and that the old definition applies. His conviction doesn't count.
No, I would not concede that, Your Honor. I would suggest that the court would have to remand this to the AAO, to the government, to the board, to the AAO to apply the law to that conviction. I can't apply the law to that conviction.
Okay,
what's your
best legal judgment about whether that conviction counts? The Missouri statute that he was convicted under and sentenced under looks like it was not an imposed suspended sentence, but a withheld suspended sentence, which means under that old definition, as I understand it, it doesn't count. And I may not be using the correct terms, but
I think that's true, but the difficulty faced there is our settlement agreement says you apply the precedents that would have been applied in 87 and 88.
I'm asking you to assume that we're going to reject that argument. Just indulge me, okay?
I need to go further than that, Your Honor, because Oscott came out in January of 88, so we don't even know what would have been applied. And we don't know what would have been applied in 1987. It's not clear that Oscott would have been applied. Our agreement says what would have been applied during the application period. Oscott came out in January of 88. The memo that he cites that says the agency should apply Oscott came out in April of 88, which was 2 weeks before the end of the application period. So it's not clear
what
would have been
applied. You don't know what definition.
I don't know what definition. I think it would have gone back probably to that old Supreme Court decision, but it's not clear to me what the agency would have applied in 87 and 88.
And what did that old Supreme Court decision say?
It's...
Would his conviction count?
I don't think it would.
Okay.
But it's broad. It's less narrow than anything here. Less clear than anything here.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Norwood. Mr. Theriot Orr?
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of points on rebuttal. The memo that he's referring to is reproduced in the Appendix F to the petitioner's appendices, and it's very clear. I mean, the Norton memo was released specifically to deal with this issue, with the issue because these adjudicators were dealing with all of these amnesty applications, and some people had convictions, and some of them had deferred adjudications, and the decisions were going all over the place. And so the agency took it upon themselves to say, Oscock's come out, that's the law. That's the law that applies to amnesty cases. The memo is crystal clear. And as to your question, Judge Sykes, as to whether his conviction is would count under Oscock, it clearly wouldn't. And the record cite to that is DHS administrative record 223 to 224, where the sentencing judge specifically says, if I revoke your probation, you only have 90 days to set aside the finding of guilt. Well, that's the key thing in Oscok. If you can set aside the finding of guilt, there's further proceedings available as to your guilt or innocence. And, in fact, my client has maintained his innocence of that charge to this day and has, like, tried to file post-conviction relief to get out from it. And the Missouri court said, we don't have jurisdiction. There's no conviction.
Yeah, that was really curious to me. It was a conviction entered on a plea.
No, it was a finding of guilt. He pled not guilty. He pled not guilty. Okay. It was a finding of guilt after a bench trial.
Okay.
And he pled not guilty and maintained at sentencing that he was innocent. Now, I'm not familiar with the facts of that at all. All I know is what's in the record. But
the special procedure under Missouri law, and what is the correct terminology for this form of sentence?
It's a suspended imposition of sentence.
Okay.
And so what it means is that the court says, I'm not going to enter judgment against you. I'm going to put you on probation. If you have good behavior, then we're going to dismiss the case. And the case remains pending the entire time.
Right.
So
we call that a withheld sentence.
Yeah. And then, regarding the authority of the Attorney General to enter into the settlement, even assuming which...
So you're saying in that situation there isn't a judgment that's rescinded or remains pending. So no actual judgment of a conviction.
No judgment exists. That's why he couldn't get post-conviction relief. The court said, I can't even, there's no judgment to do anything with. The second point on the authority of the Attorney General, even assuming, which I certainly don't concede, that the Attorney General didn't have authority to enter into this, that's irrelevant to this court. I mean, if they believe that the AG's authority didn't have authority to enter into the settlement, they need to go talk to the Eastern District of California and try to get this settlement undone 7 years after the fact. Clearly, the AG has such authority under this court's case in Batotnick, clearly finding that nunk-pro-tunk relief is appropriate where you have something like this, where you have an administrative agency which has an error and thereby deprives someone of a right that they would have had but for the agency error. So there's clear authority for that kind of relief, and the district judge found that it was appropriate in this case. If there's no further questions, I see my time has expired.
Can I just ask you about what's your response to the government's position that they're, even if we take the affidavits and give them greater weight than appears to have occurred at the appellate level, that there remain substantial gaps in time?
Well, I think that the evidence is that we have wage-earning evidence from 85, 86, and 88, and that's considered by the agency to be quite compelling. And then we have a testimony from Mr. Kaja saying he lived with me from 1982 to 1985 at this address. And then we have several other affidavits also corroborating his presence during that 82 to 85 period before the wage-earning statements pick up. So, I don't think there's...
In his adult years, we really don't have much in the way of wage-earning, do we?
Well, in the 90s, sure we do, but then it's not relevant for the amnesty application. So, he wanted to be here today, but he was working, so... Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. And thank you to Mr. Norwood for his heroic efforts on behalf of his client. Last case.